Our next discussant certainly needs no introduction to this group, as indeed Stephen Tanzer did not. He is one of the founding fathers of modern conservatism. Mr. Whelan spoke of the liberation which came in the early 50s, the liberation from what was then an antiquated conservative ideology, which Eisenhower in his heart believed, but in his practice avoided. It was precisely this time at which two or three men, by their voices, their books, their influence, molded the movement, much of which is now incorporated in the figures who are gathered together in this room. It was Friedrich Hayek, it was Richard Weaver, and it was above all Russell Kirk with his conservative mind. He began then, he has never stopped, turning out book after book. I have here before me an official biography which stops at his writing of the Eliot book. Well, that is about six books back. Since then, such important publications as The Roots of American Order have appeared, which is now used in countless schools as a textbook, for which purpose it was precisely written. Russell Kirk will give some very important additions to the discussion and to the enrichment of our thoughts tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Whelan's paper, so penetrating and so lively, offers a great many themes for comment, but let me restrict myself just to really one of the themes it raises, and that is the contrast of the presidential office with the character of the men who ordinarily occupy it. The office of the President of the United States is a kingly office, kingly in the sense that Plato uses the term kingly, and it was designed to be. Sir Henry Maine remarks that clearly the framers of the American Constitution had in mind, when they created the office of the President, the powers possessed by George III. They never said so, of course. It would be highly imprudent to say so in public. Those were exactly the powers they had in mind, the powers possessed at that time by George III, and those are the powers which they conferred upon the American president. And one may remark that Washington had, in a way, an attitude of George III once he was in office. Washington's repeated misgivings, public misgivings about faction, what you meant party, are rather like the alarm which George III felt at being restrained by the Rockingham Whigs. In short, it was the president who was to lead. There'd be no factions, no real parties. It is a kingly office. The trouble is that we've had a kingly office. We've had very few kings, very few presidents of kingly character. Washington was indeed of kingly character. But as Henry Adams remarks, the progress of the presidency from Washington to Grant refutes Darwin's entire theory of evolution. What Adams would say at more recent events, I hesitate to think about. At any rate, we've usually had feeble presidents. Not just the last four or five, not just since Franklin Roosevelt, but usually our presidents are feeble men. Relatively speaking, they're obviously highly superior, even the worst of them, in talents and character to the average citizen, true. But they're not kings. They're not men of a kingly character, and there are reasons for that. You'll recall that Alexis de Tocqueville remarks that in Democracy in America that no great man would risk his life and his honor to become president. No great man would risk his life and honor to become president because, says Tocqueville, the rewards of the office are too small and too ephemeral, and therefore, he says, we get mediocre, the Americans get mediocre presidents, and that's what they like. Rice, of course, made similar remarks later. In general, we have relative mediocrity, not that the sense of the president is an average Joe, but that he is not a distinguished man of kingly character and mold. Occasionally, we do get a kingly president, sometimes on very unlikely soil. Abraham Lincoln would be the most conspicuous example. Sometimes crisis, as in the case of Lincoln, raises up such a man, or perhaps providence, very strange how they sometimes appear. At any rate, there have been some, but not for quite a while. The only kingly president in our own time has, of course, been Franklin Roosevelt. Herbert Hoover was a man well qualified to be president, many admirable talents, but for certain matters, not kingly. Roosevelt was kingly. Franklin Roosevelt was kingly. But one is reminded, of course, of the description of Cromwell by Edmund Burke, Cromwell, that great bad man. Not a king of whom many of us love to live under, Franklin Roosevelt. I'll return to that in a moment. Now, why is it that we have a kingly office and unkingly presidents, and in general throughout our history? And how have we gotten along so far with this anomaly? Have we gotten along until the present for a variety of reasons? First of all, until recent decades, the president didn't have to do very much, even strong and kingly presidents. Remember this, that Theodore Roosevelt, who was a kingly president, spent his summers at Oyster Bay, Long Island, and the presidential offices were then above a drugstore that still exists in the center of Oyster Bay. That was the White House for the summer, with a couple of secretaries sitting around, a couple of porters. That's all you needed, even in the case of a very energetic and able president like Theodore Roosevelt. The president didn't really have so much to do, and therefore he could do it pretty well. And even if he were a man of no great talents, he managed ordinarily well enough. Harding, indeed, might be bewildered by the enormous mass of papers in his desk. You recall the incident in which Harding, early in his term, receives a visitor, a journalist. Harding is shuffling over a great mass of papers in his desk and muttering half to himself, half to the visitor, somewhere there is a man in this country who can tell me what to do about all this. But where is he? And he couldn't find him. The burden was already getting harder, heavier. Nevertheless, that was one reason why we, the presidents, got along well enough, because we didn't give them too much to do. And the second reason was that America, comparatively isolated from the perils of diplomacy and war, didn't have to make hasty decisions that couldn't be revoked in foreign affairs. There was leisure, there was time, there was a great big moat. And even though the president might make serious mistakes in diplomacy or even in military affairs, still the potential strength of the United States, the elapse of time, the big moat, the power of the British Navy, all these prevented unpleasant immediate consequences to the United States. And so we could get along for a long time with mediocrity, most of the time, in the presidency. Well, why this feebleness? Why haven't we selected kingly men for a kingly office? In part, of course, has been democratism. The notion that, most Americans are mediocre. Why shouldn't we have a mediocre president? Mediocrity has a right to representation, too. That's been that view, in part. Also, the method of selection. The amorphous character of American parties, which American parties have virtually no central offices, no continuity, no real direction, almost no thought. You don't produce by party a man who of long party experience, elevated mind, strong character. He doesn't ordinarily come out of American party. That's one reason. Another reason is the disgrace of the primaries, that horrible delusion of the progressive era that we'd get wonderful kingly men if only we referred to these divine people, vox populi. The primaries have been a disgrace in the beginning, and they're now worse than ever. And there's one reason for hope coming in, a little cheerfulness breaking in, that the public now realizes the primaries are a mess, and the popular primary is now unpopular. It was almost abolished this year in Michigan, very close squeak, and is going to be abolished before the next presidential election rolls around in Michigan. They're going to get rid of it. The primary they see is a nuisance, a curse, and it is mischief. And other people, other states are realizing that too. The disgrace of the primaries, but also the disgrace of national conventions, which are a hideous mess and essentially a corrupt institution. Things went somewhat better when, of course, there weren't any national conventions. There were simply state conventions and endorsements by state legislatures and other bodies. This prevailed, of course, down until the 1830s, and to some extent, a while after that, and was, after all, whatever the defects of this method, a better method than either national convention or primary for selecting a decent and able man as the candidate of a party. And the biggest reason of all for the recent feebleness, I think, is the enormous burden of office. We've piled powers upon the president, partly at the president's request and partly at the insistence of Congress, and of special interests which no man can bear. This is a point about the modern statesman which Wilhelm Repke made frequently and strongly in his books. Repke pointed out that any man, even the most talented, has only 24 hours a day. That you cannot pile increasing work upon him and expect him to last. The presidency becomes a killing job or a job which must be shrug your shoulders at and spend your time on the campaign trail trying to get reelected regardless of what happens to policy. That's happened now. There is simply too much work for the president to do, and therefore it is done badly or done often not at all. And the real power passes not to the president, but to the anonymous executive force, the executive force of which Alfred de Grazia has written so well. There's where the real power lies, not in the presidency, but in this faceless body of persons. It's hard to say how many there are. A figure 600 is given by some, 1,500 by others. But the people around the White House who determine things, and who determine things often without the president's consent, and actually against his will and intention in foreign affairs and in domestic. And as Mr. Whalen pointed out, the president seems especially ineffectual in dealing with his own executive force. These are reasons for the feebleness in general and the particular feebleness of recent years. Can anything be done about it? Well, certain things could be done. They're not likely to be done unless we experience extreme adversity. Unless, indeed, the whole political apparatus seems to be breaking down. If there's a great vast depression and further reverses in foreign policy, even military defeats on the grand scale, then something might be done to reform the presidential office and to reform Congress, too. In the case of the presidency, one thinks of some alternative to primaries and national conventions and the rest of the present mess. One might try to establish constitutionally a genuine electoral college. The first electoral college, or the one that nominally still exists, never did work for obvious reasons. It was too easy to pledge the electors to a particular candidate from the very first. The electoral college could be a real electoral college. It is a body of sober and experienced persons who would select the president. Well, one can't outline that here now. You might imagine an electoral college made up of state governors or of nominations and selection by state legislatures, something which is not selection by Congress and yet is neither convention nor primary. At any rate, a better method of selecting presidents would be part of it. And we may be forced to think about such things and perhaps act upon them. At the same time, though I sympathize with Mr. Whalen's analysis of the present weakness of the presidency, its feebleness, nevertheless, I'm sure that Mr. Whalen is aware of the dangers in the renewal or reinvigoration of the presidency, which he urges. Many here will remember an interesting book published a few years ago, or about a quarter of a century ago, by De Riencourt, The Coming American Caesars. The kingly office can be also the office of a tyrant, or of a Caesar, a man whose power is primarily military and who thinks in a military way, and who in the long run will say, with Septimius Severus speaking to his sons on his deathbed at York, such a man will say, like Septimius Severus, when the sons ask him, "How are we to govern the world when you are gone, father?" He'll reply with old Septimius, "Pay the soldiers. The rest do not matter." The danger of a Caesar, president, with powers greater than ever before. Those dangers existed, of course, and as Mr. Whalen points out, in the Franklin Roosevelt's time. Indulge me in one anecdote related to me by the Archduke Otto von Habsburg. The Archduke Otto was intimate with Franklin Roosevelt during the Second World War, when the Archduke was residing in America. Franklin Roosevelt entertained him with prospects of some kind of restoration with American power. Roosevelt had no intention of doing anything of the sort, but it amused Roosevelt to play with people like that and their hopes. So the Archducado had easy entree into the presidential offices. One day, just before the American landing at Dakar, the Archducado entered Roosevelt's office. This hasn't been published anywhere except by me. President Roosevelt was full of high spirits and said, well, Otto, tomorrow's going to be a big day. And I'll swear you to secrecy on this, but it doesn't really matter if you talk because it's too late for talk to do any harm anyway. But I'll tell you what's going to happen. Tomorrow, our troops land at Dakar. We will, of course, take Dakar. After that, all of French Africa. But that's only the beginning, Otto. Hereafter, Africa is American. The peoples of Africa will follow the American mode of government, manners, economy. We will drive out the French, British, Spanish, Portuguese, and other imperialists. Africa hereafter is American. And the Archducado said, Mr. Roosevelt, General de Gaulle may not share your aspirations. And Roosevelt replied, De Gaulle? Who is de Gaulle? What is France? If the French object, we'll wipe them off the face of the earth. And there, said the Archducado to me, is the intoxication of power. He said, Roosevelt was not a bad man, a man of good intentions, an amiable man by and large, but a man intoxicated with power and his possession. There was, of course, no successful landing at Dakar. It was repulsed. The next day, things went very differently. But this illustrates the danger of an American Caesar. After all, the strong foreign policies of Roosevelt in the long run were disastrous in many ways, terrible ways. And we feel their effect still. One can be strong and vigorous and yet unwise. And so it is necessary always that there be a check of the legislative power and a strong check upon presidential ambition. The president may indeed be a constitutional monarch, but not a tyrant. And to maintain that tension, that necessary tension between the claims of the legislative and the claims of the executive is a great problem of our time, upon one aspect of which Mr. Whalen has so ably touched.